Wednesday, June 20th, 1984. We're doing an interview with Dr. Jay Barton, President of the University of Alaska. Present are Dr. Barton, Paul McCarthy, and Bill Schneider. The first session we anticipate dealing with the personal and professional background of Dr. Barton. Dr. Barton, what kind of, what was your, where were you born? I'll just start off that way, that's the easiest way.
Okay, I was born in Chicago, 1922, and lived in Chicago for, some first and second grade, I think. And then in 1930, we moved out to a western suburb called Batavia in the Fox River Valley. Do you know the area, Paul?
I know the downtown area in Chicago and some of the suburbs, Oak Park and some of the other parts, but not heard of Batavia.
That's west, straight west.
Straight west. Yeah. Would that be near O'Hara?
Oh, well, farther west than that.
Farther west than that, so that must be about 40 or 50 miles out.
About 40 miles.
Is that pretty close to the Wisconsin border, or is it in Wisconsin?
It's a good 60 miles from Wisconsin border. It almost due west of Chicago. Our home in Chicago in Chicago was right near Lakeshore Drive and Belmont Avenue. And my earliest memories are the big rocks on the boat harbor, the Belmont Harbor. And going back in later years, you could see how small those rocks really were.
The shoreline has changed.
The shoreline has changed, right?
I go there about three times a year now for a professional governing board meeting. It really is both delightful but heavily. What were your parents doing in Chicago? What did your father do?
My father was working with the People's Gas, Light and Co. Company. I think his job title was personnel director or employee training. It wasn't personnel director because they didn't really have personnel directors in those days. But he was involved in safety programs. He was an engineer. Mm-hmm. Safety programs and training programs that involved some of the technicalities of gas companies in those days. My mother was an artist, and she was trained at the Chicago Art Institute. Came out of Jefferson City, Missouri as a family of 13 children, I think. And in those days, you only went to high school, if you were a woman or a girl, you only went to high school 2 years. That was enough education for women. And in Jefferson City, Missouri, you were expected to go to work at the state capitol as a secretary and save enough money to buy a trousseau or something like that, and then get married, and that was your life. But she had other ideas. And she did go to work at the Capitol and did save her money, but went to the Art Institute and spent a couple of years there in training. And then opened a commercial art office in Chicago in 1919, I think, with Helen Hokanson. Does that name sound familiar to you, Paul? She did all those cartoons in the New Yorker of women in big garden party hats and great big well-developed women, mm-hmm. making all sorts of pious middle-class thoughts about everything from Robert's Rules of Order to who knows what. But she was a very witty woman. Well, the two of them ran a commercial art operation for a number of years. And my mother had known my father before in Jefferson City. And as an engineer, he was working for the state, I believe, at that time. He was a chemical engineer. But he didn't manage to hold her in Jefferson City, and so he followed her to Chicago.
And, oh, really?
That was how he ended up at the People's Gas Company.
Where did he take his engineering training?
University of Missouri. Yeah, my roots for the last generation really have been in Missouri. My mother's family was in Missouri, and his family also. And he went to the University of Missouri, and I think graduated in 1913, thereabouts. No, that's too early. It was near the war, because he served in the war. Mm-hmm. And so I had a ROTC commission, so it must have been around 1917 or 1918 that he graduated, so along in there.
So you were about 7 when they moved from Chicago out to the Tate.
Right, right. And that was a small city of about 5,000. So I really grew up in a small town environment rather than an urban environment. But because my father still worked in Chicago, I did a lot of commuting. We'd often go in every Saturday, mm-hmm. and spend the afternoon with him at a museum, or the morning at a museum and the afternoon at a play or a civic opera or something like that. And mm-hmm. those were the days when you worked in the Saturday mornings. You remember the work week was 45 hours or 44 hours, whatever, mm-hmm. before the NRA.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
So we knew Chicago well, and my mother was still doing a lot of commercial art, but she worked at home, and she was often in Chicago too. So we had, although it wasn't really a suburban area in the modern terminology, it wasn't a bedroom community. Mm-hmm. Really, it was a community in its own right. Made windmills, which sort of went out of style about then.
Really?
Yeah.
They just missed the gap between the old windmill and now the...
That's right. That's right. It's interesting that there have been efforts to revive that, and some of the patents have been dug out again.
Have they?
But the Challenge Wind Engine and Pump Company is down the tubes a long time.
You went to grammar school and high school there?
In high school, right. And then went to the University of Missouri, primarily because my father had been there, the University of Missouri.
You took essentially a college preparatory
mm-hmm.
routine
mm-hmm.
in high school. What high school did you go to?
The Batavia Public High. Yeah, it was the 2 years of Latin, 2 years of French, 4 years of mathematics, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. that was expected for academically oriented people. In fact, that was really the standard program for almost everybody. Yeah. There was a home economics program for women. It was highly discriminatory there.
when you begin looking back on some of the background that you had and family expectations, what do you perceive as, do you perceive any particular events or values as coming forth or that were really important to your life? You know, it would seem that going to college was one strong expectation.
I've looked later, that is with the perspective of hindsight. Most of us in education recognize that the people that do well in school and have a high chance of succeeding in college are people who come from homes where there are books and readers. And I think in retrospect it probably was the fact that my mother read and my father read, and there were libraries and there were magazines. That is, my father had a library right in the house. That perhaps more than any other single thing probably influenced me and my brothers. That we know that's a major impact. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendously high correlation between active reading in the home and the availability of books and papers and success in college. Mm-hmm. I literally read the Batavia Public Library by the time I finished high school. Literally. Mm-hmm. It was not too hard to do. It wasn't all that big. But I was an eclectic reader. I read everything and learned a lot, I think, that way.
When you look back in terms of your mother's experience, the sense I have is that you have an expectation of not only equal opportunity, but really the incentive to develop all
yeah,
of your gifts.
My mother and I often talked. She felt that she would like to have had the kind of education my father had, the kind of education I was getting. You know, she really wanted an academic career. That's what it came down to.
Really?
Yeah. And yet, in those days, it was almost impossible out of a community like Jefferson City to achieve that. It would have taken superhuman efforts and real pressures from her parents or support from her parents, and she didn't have that. That was a different culture. I think all her life she wanted to be a doctor, and of course she wanted me to be a doctor, and I would be off and on that, and eventually decided that was not for me. And she finally realized that her wish for me was really her wish for herself. Exactly what she wanted to be. She wanted that deep intellectual challenge. And in her later years, she wrote rather than painted or drew, and was much less successful as a writer in terms of selling what she wrote, but found it much more satisfying to her. She was much more pleased with what she did than she was with some of the commercial art that she did.
How large a family did you come from?
I had two brothers, one brother that's a year and a half younger than I, and another brother who's 14 years younger than I. So he was born, I think, when I was a freshman in high school.
When you went to the University of Missouri, then had you targeted as a biology major?
No, but I had targeted science. And I started out really in chemistry, and I ended up in life sciences after I learned more about life sciences. In those days, you had to be a zoologist or a botanist, or the idea that there was a unified theory of life hadn't really permeated yet, and mm-hmm. very modern development. So I ended up before the war in chemistry and in biology, and then after the break for the war, came back and looked for the fastest way possible to get a degree, and that turned out to be in chemistry on the baccalaureate level. And then I entered graduate school as a zoologist right there at Missouri. And I think primarily because of one person, a man named Mazia, Dan Mazia, who taught a class that I took as a senior called Cell Biology. And it was the sort of class where all the things that you learned, I'm sure you had that experience too, all the things that you learned that people had said, you have to take it, it's good for you, or you have to take it because it's important to something else, it all made sense. And I understood why chemistry and biology were related and what the role of physics was. And we read papers in foreign languages. I suddenly understood why I really had to know German. It was critical. And all of that made sense. It was all integrated. It was a very richly rewarding experience. And to the fact that this man, Dan Mazia, was an unbelievably bright man who, when he lectured, gave you some insight into how he thought. And I'm a firm believer that lectures are useful. You know, it's not the waste of time that mm-hmm. people think that. And it really is a useful thing to do, not just to pass out information. If you're going to read a book, it's easier to read the book. But if you give a lecture and what you really are doing is letting people see how your mind works, I think that's a very valuable thing. Bronowski, did you all see The Ascent of Man? Didn't you feel in listening to Bronowski that he wasn't just transmitting information, you were learning about how Bronowski thought? Well, that's what I felt about Dan Mazia. He would come we had a combined lecture laboratory, so the whole afternoon was devoted to cell biology. And he'd come in with one sheet of yellow paper, and you could see on a very lousy portable typewriter, he typed about three or four lines on it. He'd talk with us for 3 hours. He'd sort of roll his eyes into the back of his head and come out with all these neat things on what cells were doing and why they were doing it. And that's when I realized what the intellectual life really was all about and why graduate school really was important. And that's when I decided that a career as a scientist is what I really wanted.
So that was in your senior year?
Right.
At the baccalaureate level?
Right.
Were there other professors that particularly struck you or excited you, got you interested in different aspects of science?
I think he was the most important influence. There were other other people I liked. Lou Stadler was there in genetics at the time, and he too was a, the current phrase is world class. He discovered the mutagenic effects of X radiation, but his organism was maize rather than fruit flies. So Muller over in Indiana beat him to publication with his work on fruit flies because they breed in 21 days, whereas it takes a whole season for corn. But he was a great scientist and a great person, and I learned something about the personal relationships of scientists. There's a real, at least in those days, before science became big business, there was a real camaraderie. There were relatively few cell biologists, I think a handful, maybe a dozen in the country. I knew them all. I met them in Woods Hole in the summertime. They were all part of a very close fraternity, and people weren't well paid. I think before the war, an instructor at the University of Missouri got about $900 a year. Well, before the war, that might have even paid for a maid. You can't tell. It wasn't too bad an amount of money for that day. But nobody went into it for money. Maceo said one night as we were working together, he said, it was 2 a.m, I think, and some things had just gone well. He said, he sat back in his chair, he said, you know, they pay us to do this. Well, that's part of what so many people in that post-war year or in the pre-war years too really felt about science. It really was a vocation, not a job, because there wasn't any deep financial reward. I had one of the first fellowships to support the training of scientists, the Atomic Energy Commission, which had a lot of money after the war, in cooperation with the National Research Council, started a fellowship program to train scientists. And except for the Navy, the Office of Naval Research, this is the first effort of the government to take a national policy in developing scientists. And I think it paid me $750 a year, something like that. It was great. It's just what I needed. At Woods Hole in the summer, biologists would come together at the Marine Laboratory up there. It was founded by Louis Agassiz back in the 19th century. And it was more of an intellectual center than a laboratory. It was a laboratory too, but it was just as much of a place where people came to talk, to share their ideas, to get new ideas, and teaching was an integral part of that. You went there as a student, and you could. There were something like 3 major classes that lasted all summer, and taught by the world's leading scientists. And you all may not know the names, but Otto Warburg came, a tremendous German scientist. I'm going to block on the names. Fermi was there, even though he's not a life scientist. Most of the physicists of the day were interested in life science. Zent Georgi, a Nobel laureate. Otto Loewi, another Nobel laureate. And we lived in very simple little Cape Cod-type cottages, with almost unfinished, in very simple quarters, and ate in a common dining room, and would sit around at night listening to Loewi talk about whatever he wanted to talk about. It was a remarkable experience, and it will never be duplicated. You know, that we had in those days that whole immigration from Europe. Lots of people driven out because they were Jews, lots of people coming just because it was torn up. And our whole intellectual and scientific community was so tremendously enriched by that. Well, right after the war, they were in the prime of their productivity, and there they were. It was truly a remarkable period. Then in the 50s, of course, science became very much a matter of national policy, when we constantly failed to develop a bomb that Sputnik that fired. We couldn't get to space. We did all sorts of things wrong, and we started the National Defense Education Act, and we started the National Science Foundation. We started all sorts of ways in which federal policy influenced science.
to go back for.
You don't want my lecture on science, yeah?
No, I think I'm really interested in following that up because one of my concerns here at the university is the science that we are involved with may not be well documented in terms of understanding the contribution of the university. Because my sense is that many scientists do their work and aren't particularly adept at documenting what they've done and see that the output of modern science is a published paper or the professional presentation, but don't have, or we don't have people who are beginning to weave all the contributions together.
And put it in some sort of perspective, on what it means in the nation, what it means in the whole intellectual history of man.
And maybe almost a distortion that we have begun to see science as almost a technology on demand that can solve problems without any understanding of the human as well as the laboratory dimension.
Oh, I think you're right on that. Yeah. In my enthusiastic teaching about the nature of science, I always taught science as a habit of the mind, not a product, not even a method, and certainly not a process, but just it literally is. This goes back to Aristotle, who proposed that that's exactly what science was a habit of thinking. And that's why it's so important that we learn how scientists' minds work, not just what the product is.
When you finished your baccalaureate degree, you went on in zoology. You did that at Missouri also.
Missouri, right.
And you finished a PhD there.
Right.
Were there other instructors that excited the same kind of interest that you had in science? And I guess what I'm coming out with or what I see is, you know, we're talking about science as a habit of the mind, kind of an attitude. Your work with, is it Mazio?
M-A-Z-I-A, Mazia.
Dan
Mazia.
In terms of the excitement and trying to pull chemistry, biology together.
Yeah, I think, it was a very exciting time for biologists, especially in my field. We called it cell physiology. Today we call it molecular biology. The first course I developed at Columbia was called chemical biology rather than biochemistry, which was a medical school course. And medical school biology in those days dealt mainly with blood and urine and body fluids and was fairly physiologically oriented, not cell oriented. And my effort was to develop a chemical approach to biology that was cellular in nature rather than organismic in nature. So I called it chemical biology. I should have invented the word molecular and I'd be famous, but someone later invented molecular biology, which immediately caught hold, which was a good approach. But in those days, we were rewriting the nature of biology. Chemistry has not had a revolution in generations, but biology did in the 50s. And much of it happened at Woods Hole. Much of it, at least, was talked about at Woods Hole. Watson, whose name may be familiar to you because he's gotten a lot of personal publicity, was just a young kid who ran around in cutoffs and bare feet and sat on laboratory tables and talked with us all night long. He was just out of Harvard and lots of interesting ideas and went to England and put this thing together with Crick. It really was a habit of the mind that let him see that none of the rest of us saw. And we've kicked ourselves. We had it in our hands, the same kind of thing, and didn't put it together in the right way. And I think this has happened to scientists again and again. I remember one day a couple, a husband and wife team in France named Bondrelet, had come out with a paper that said that the amount of DNA was constant for the cell. The previous analyses would say that there's so much DNA per gram of liver, or so much DNA per gram of muscle, or so much DNA per gram of eggs, or whatever. Well, they put it on a cell count basis, Well, that's just exactly what Dan and I had been working on without really realizing what we were doing. And I picked up this journal in the library in French, and I read it, and I went down to the basement laboratory and showed it to Dan, and we knew immediately what it meant. And then the next year, here comes our good friend Watson, and I'd love to have been able to do that. We were right there on the edge of a very exciting time in the biology that totally changed the way people thought about nature. And I think all of those scientists I met at Woods Hole had a strong influence on me then. We didn't develop the technicians and the people who saw science as a job until after that. That was it suddenly became big business then. But it wasn't then. Most biologists saved what they could out of their salary so they could starve to death at Woods Hole and get back to the bank in time to keep their last check from bouncing.
You were at Woods Hole during your graduate work or
right.
After your graduate work?
Both, yeah.
Was Columbia your first appointment
right.
After graduate
school? Right.
Sounded like an interesting and challenging place to start.
It was indeed. I was truly overwhelmed. I remember going there for an interview, took the train from Missouri. Nobody really flew in those days, but you took the train. Came back very impressed with the big city and the job and everything else. Paid the enormous salary of $3,600 a year and figured I was really doing well. I was delighted.
Right. What were the courses that you were responsible for? You said that you yeah. began the course in...
Columbia recognized something that is easy to lose sight of, and that is that graduate students know more about their field than anyone else in the world, about their particular narrowly defined piece of that field. They aren't really equipped to teach freshman biology because they don't really know enough to teach a broad-based program. They really know a tiny little bit, but in that, they're the world's experts. So Columbia gives people automatic seats. That is, when you're appointed to the faculty, you're automatically appointed to the faculty of the graduate school. You have a seat on that faculty. And the first course was whatever I wanted to do to develop a course that would properly express my contribution to science. And that was, I was able to literally to write my own ticket. I mean, you weren't assigned teaching, you were asked to be a professor at Columbia, not to be a teacher of these sections, but to be a professor. I had an opportunity to teach genetics when one of our geneticists went on leave and enjoyed teaching that, and that of course was related pretty closely to what I was doing in the laboratory too. But the we were challenged, the department was challenged by the college to come up with a program in science that would be as good as Columbia's famous contemporary civilization and contemporary humanities courses. So we tinkered with that. And the result was is that I was invited to serve to a seat on the Columbia College faculty too, and taught a freshman program or a program for undergraduates on contemporary biology. Yeah.
Okay.
That's also when I got interested in teaching, and I met a dean of Columbia College, Dean Chamberlain, who felt that I probably had a stronger, he would like to have seen me develop the whole teaching aspect more aggressively than the laboratory aspect. And about the same time I met a man named Tom Jones, who was president of Earlham College in Indiana, a Quaker school. And he'd been in to see Larry Chamberlain, and Chamberlain said, why don't you go over and visit with Jay Barton over in the laboratory? And we had a long talk, and Tom said, you really ought to come out to Earlham. He said, but I think your whole Catholic background means you probably ought to come to St. Joseph's. He said, I'm going to talk to Father Gross. And I laughed. I said, look, there's the Hudson River, right? We're on the 13th floor of Pupping Hall. There's the Hudson River. This is Columbia University. I'm not going to Indiana. But a few months later, Gross came through and continued to write and call. And about a year later, Ann and I decided that he's probably right, that raising a family in New York City, even in Rockland County, is just probably not the way to go. And I was interested in teaching, and that really was a strong motivation. I was also interested in something that I haven't really explored in years. The early 50s were also times of deep ferment in Catholicism. And I had never gone to Catholic schools. I had never had a deep indoctrination. It was more a custom. My mother was a Catholic. My father eventually became a convert to Catholicism. But after World War II, there was a whole group of young people, and I happened to drop in on them when I lived in Shanks Village in Rockland County, where all the young faculty and graduate students at Columbia University lived. It was just overflow housing because there wasn't any place to for anybody else. They were converted army barracks. And I met people there who were on the cutting edge of the intellectual life and interested in Catholicism at the same time. Well, I'd never met people like that before. I met Dorothy Day. Does that name sound familiar at all? The Catholic worker? Yeah. And that whole group of intellectuals that were working in New York City at the time. And Catholicism became a totally different kind of thing. And in 1952, there were a couple of very interesting papers published on calling for a renaissance in Catholic education to get Catholic schools out of the habit of trying to save souls first and mind second, and concentrate on what universities are really all about. And people began to read Newman again on the idea of a university and recognized that these were not religious training places. These were, if they were really going to amount to anything, they had to be the life of the mind, not the life of the soul. At any rate, the great dream was that maybe we could bring about a renaissance in Catholic education. And in 1955, I did go out to St. Joseph's College as part of Gross's idea, and a man named Maziarz. Maziarz and Mazia are very close, but Maziarz was the dean, and he was pulling together young people like me from around the nation to try it at St. Joseph's College. And it was a remarkably exciting experiment. It really was fun to do. They wanted good science. They wanted good sociology. They wanted good history. They wanted good literature. They really wanted to try. And in those days, getting into college was still a very difficult kind of thing. They could be reasonably selective. They had the whole Chicago area only 80 miles away as a good recruiting area, and did well. It was a neat thing to do. We had a great time there. They finally, as costs went up, they overbuilt, and they finally decided, well, we have to admit more students than we probably should, and the quality went down, and they started to make compromises, and Maziarz left, and I went to Europe for a year, and when I came back, I decided I can't stay with that, and, mm-hmm. and didn't. But they were good years, and they were good ideas. They were
worth doing. When you were at Columbia, was your primary assignment in research with some teaching, and a major shift to teaching at St. Joseph's?
Yeah, indeed.
Who was your research supported by at Columbia?
Public Health Service, Higgins Foundation, National Science Foundation.
What was it focused on?
Physiology of the cell nucleus. How the cell nucleus worked, physiology and biochemistry of that. And what were the interactions with the cytoplasm? How did it happen? We all knew that the nucleus had all the genetic information, and the big question was, how is that genetic information expressed? How does it have an impact? And what are the relationships that went on? And my work involved everything from pure biochemistry on large quantities of cells to tracer studies, radioautographic tracer studies, in which you label certain elements in a cell population and then cut it off at various times and make slide preparations of that to see what part of the cell the isotope is in. And from that, try to deduce what's happened over that period of time. It was a good experiment. No, I didn't win the Nobel Prize. I learned about then I wasn't going to win the Nobel Prize.
When you went to St. Joseph's, I think on the video it talks about building a community physically.
Oh, we did that.
We did that. Intellectually. Yeah.
That goes hand in hand. There's a long line of people who really do think there's such a thing as a community of scholars, and that community aspect of a university is just as important as the scholar's life in isolation. In fact, it's part of the tradition of collegial relationships in a university. Well, a community gets expressed in lots of ways, and many of the religious communities, of course, had a physical community as well. About the time that I went there, the Ford Foundation was giving away large blocks of money to private schools around the nation, essentially with a challenge of, what can you do with this? We're going to give you a very modest endowment. Do something with us and report back in 20 years as to what you've done with it. And they were looking for ways, and no heavy accountability. You didn't have annual reports. They were looking for institutions to do something out of the ordinary, not just buy AT&T stock, but something creative with it. And what we came up with, and it was a community effort that led to the decision finally, let's build a community. Let's use this money to hold the resource, to hold and develop the resource that really, really makes a college, and that is the faculty. So we literally built a community of about a dozen homes in a little wooded area, and did everything from, I'm a surveyor by avocation. I learned how to survey in the war. I did the survey for the road for a whole bunch of other things. It was fun to do. Mm-hmm. And we found an architect in Indiana, of all places, who shared some of this enthusiasm and helped put this thing together so we didn't just have a row houses, but we had individually designed houses with some common themes that didn't necessarily make them cheaper to build, but did make the whole thing become a community rather than just a collection of houses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was fun to do. A very idealistic and probably, we thought we knew this. We knew that no utopia had ever succeeded, that it was probably theoretically or certainly pragmatically impossible. And yet we thought, now if we take these certain things into account, maybe we can succeed where others have failed. We didn't really. Although the community is still in existence, its community aspects are less visible now than they once were.
What do you see as the reasons for its lack of gelling? And is this in a larger way what happens in a modern university where we have faculties who have very little interaction with one another?
Well, one of the things that holds any organization together is a shared common myth. You can call them goals and objectives, but in the end it's a common myth because it has to be more than just shared goals and objectives. You have to have some common understanding as to your origins and how you got here, and I don't mean in any cosmic sense, but why the institution exists as well as where you want to go. IBM has a good myth, and myths are not all false. This isn't a lie. It's just an epic way of describing the company. IBM has a great myth, and people can have allegiance to that and feel part of a common brotherhood or a common community without any difficulty at all. Most of the great communities that lasted for any reasonable length of time had a fairly well-defined mythology and that did hold them together. it's hard to do that in this modern age. There's a lot more cynicism than there ever was before. It's hard, except in a few times of the year, to deal with the university as a community of scholars. There are practically no occasions where a modern university even meets together anymore. There are two occasions at West Virginia in which we met together. One was in football games in the stadium, and the other was at convocations for graduation. And in neither case was that conducive to emphasizing the community of scholars. And I don't know how often you meet here as a total faculty in which you really do come to grips with what the university is all about, but my guess is almost zero. Now, it's easier to do in a small school like St. Joseph's College with I think we had 1,200 or 1,500 students, 100 faculty or so. That was fairly easy to do, but not indefinitely, because there's enough cynicism in this modern age and enough rejection of mythology, so it was very hard to get 100 people to agree that this indeed was our common set of objectives. And you'd start out with a good group, and then there'd be a change or two, and by the time they got indoctrinated, things had modified again, and pretty soon, without constant attention, that myth begins to fade. Interestingly enough, there have been some books in the last year or so on corporate cultures that have talked about some of these same issues in corporate terms. One fascinating one called The Image at the Top. And the main thesis of this is that what really motivates an employee is how that employee perceives the president or the chief executive officer. What image does that person really present? I'm not sure that I concur in all this, but it's an aspect of the idea I gave you earlier, that there has to be a common mythology to tie things together. And without really analyzing it in my early work in administration, I worked on that basis. That's how I, moving into the biology department at West Virginia when I became chairman of that department, my whole objective that first year was to create a myth, a belief in what that department was and what it was all about and what it was going to be. And again, with 30 people in a department, that was fairly easy to do. That was not the difficulty it is to move 1,000 faculty members. And I don't think any modern university can really maintain that except by professing allegiance to things in the past. You know, Harvard and Yale can talk about the great days of the 17th and 18th century or 19th century, but that doesn't really change behavior anymore. That just gives them a common theme to write in the alumni magazines. You need more than that.
When you left St. Joseph's, you went and worked with undergrad for the National Science Foundation
to study. Right.
Was it undergraduate or graduate education?
It was university education, college level education, but essentially undergraduate. We touched on some graduate programs, but its title was undergraduate education.
And focusing on biological sciences.
Yeah, right.
Where did you study that?
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. Technically, I had an appointment at George Washington University, but we worked out of offices in various locations in the city. And my main contribution to that effort was to describe for the whole biological community what the current understanding of the common core of biological knowledge was in some of our best schools. And we defined best school not by reputation, but by those schools that had paid systematic departmental attention to the nature of instruction at the freshman level, to what happened then. The hypothesis was that, who was it that said the unexamined life is the unlived life? Well, the unexamined curriculum is the irrelevant curriculum. And a handful of departments, Purdue among others, had spent a great deal of departmental time of getting departments to work together to decide what really should be taught in freshman biology, not to leave it up to the graduate students or the first year faculty member or somebody who wrote a textbook a decade ago, but somehow that first year had to have some serious attention. And out of that grew the feeling that the whole undergraduate curriculum needed revamping, and the result was is that this commission was founded to try to see if we couldn't set up ways in which colleges could teach what biology really now was after this revolution in the 50s, rather than what it had been. And what it had been is generally a course in botany in which you learned how to tell corn plants away from pine trees, and then a series of other courses in which the first chapters were always just about the same thing, and had introduction to the cell in chapter one of just about every book. It was not a program that really reflected what biology was. If you were in zoology, for instance, at the time, you probably had histology, physiology, probably didn't have cell physiology. There weren't enough cell physiologists in the country to do it in those early days, at any rate. You had a medically oriented program, one dominated by pre-meds for the most part. So it was organismic at best. Probably didn't reflect the fact that plants were as important as animals, and certainly didn't reflect the fact that cells were as important as organisms. And that wasn't the nature of biology. Everyone knew at this, not everyone, but the scientists knew at this point that there really was a single form of life, that we really were all related. All these forms were, the reason there's such a commonality of function and structure really has to do with the fact that they all had a common origin. And understanding that made unity or identified unity of life was far more important than diversity. Most of our university courses talked about all the different animals and all the different plants and all the different kinds of cells. Well, it was important at some point to talk about the fact that they all had DNA, they all had the same genetic information, they all had messenger RNA, they all had the same basic functions, rather than to emphasize the differences. And so some of this had to show up in the curriculum. Stanford had an interesting program. Don Kennedy, who is now president at Stanford, was then chairman of the biology department. And he had totally revamped the way biology was taught there at Stanford. Henry Koeffler, who is now president of the University of Arizona, was chairman of biology at Purdue. And he had totally redone biology at Purdue in very thoughtful ways. Dartmouth had made a stab. They had worked at it. North Carolina was a land-grant school that had tried to get the botanists and the zoologists to work together with mixed success. They had developed an armed truce, is what it was. But out of that truce came a program that the students benefited from, so it wasn't all that bad. There were a handful of other places, and those are the programs that I studied and wrote about and reported on, and on what was the core curriculum in biology. It was an interesting effort. I really did it, Paul, for some very special reasons. I knew that I had to leave St. Joseph's College, or at least I wanted to. And to do that gracefully meant I needed much more visibility than I could gain in a small Catholic college in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I also needed to look to see what was moving. And at that point, I decided I had to get back into public education rather than private. See, that first 15 years had been all in private education. Mm-hmm. And at that point, with the direction that the economy was going and the federal government was going and Lyndon Johnson was going, public education was clearly the direction of the future. So I literally decided I had to get into public education. I had to get into a land-grant campus. That was the kind of public education I wanted to be involved in. And when I had the opportunity to go to West Virginia as chairman of biology, I thought, what could be better? I'd love to be a biology chairman for the rest of my life and really create what I've been preaching there at in that land-grant campus.
I was just going to ask you if the 2 years study on undergraduate curriculum was one of the implementing it was one of the challenges of moving to West Virginia.
Absolutely. That was that was indeed the challenge. Tied to that was the challenge that enrollments have been growing at something like 20 to 25% per year. Budgets have not been growing quite as fast, and there weren't enough faculty, even if you had the money. Those were the days where you courted people. You had to find a cell biologist somewhere, and there weren't that many. Mm-hmm. We had more than 2,000 students in Biology 1 each semester. And when I talk about numbers like that in Alaska, they seem unbelievable, but it's a different world at that scale. And the freshman class was about 3,300 students, and most of those thought they were interested in nursing or medicine or something, and biology seemed simpler than chemistry. So between those who elected it as a liberal arts requirement and those who had career plans, two-thirds of the class wanted to take the first year of biology. And they were teaching it in some 30 sections, and in just everybody in the department was teaching as many sections of biology as possible. It was just, and everything else was being neglected. It was just not well done. And so I had also been involved in some technology and education efforts in Washington. Those are the days that the government was holding hearings on science and education and technology, that people were worrying about programmed instruction, and I moved in that group for a while. And so when I came to West Virginia, I started a TV program, televised biology, on the hypothesis that we can, by this technique, give every student the best we can offer in any particular aspect of biology, even though we can't give them the person himself or herself. And it worked. We made tests, gave exams and that sort of thing, and compared them, and found that more people did learn more biology, no question about it, but they liked it less. This was West Virginia. These were people that were used to very personal approaches and very polite. That's one of the reasons I went out there. I was struck by the warmth and the gentleness and the basic courtesy of West Virginians. It was a very nice experience. They would never criticize a teacher. You know, that was a figure of authority that was like their parents, and they would never criticize, maybe over a beer somewhere else, but not face-to-face or not in a written evaluation or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But TV loosened that. This was an image on a screen. This was no longer Professor so-and-so. And so we got far more frank evaluations of that, of how they liked the class, than we would have had it been a live kind of program. Interesting experience. It gave me deep insights into what television can do and what it can't do. We changed dramatically to get people involved. We would run the tape, I think some 20 times a day, you know, but we would run the tape in such a way that it would stop halfway through, and a lab instructor or a faculty member or I, you know, we took turns at this, would talk with the class about what had happened and ask for questions and to try to get a personal feel into it. And I think we helped that. But we always were comfortable in the fact that people learn biology, and they learn good biology. No faculty member cut the lecture. No one loused up on the lecture. The lectures were all decent. The demonstrations went well, you know. And they really did better on tests. You can learn that way, but it does take, they want support. There's a current phrase, high technology, low touch, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that phrase? I think I've got it wrong, but it's something like that, Paul. Mm-hmm. That with the highest of high technology, you still have to have a people presence now.
It seems to me that that's one of the really real challenges of current education. Yeah. Is to rely totally on high technology, I think, ignores the relationship problem or opportunity
right.
that we have with
right.
other scholars or students. And I guess I'm really interested in that, yeah. approach in your evaluation of the problem.
Yet we also have to compensate for the fact that relatively few people are good scientists, and perhaps even fewer are good teachers. Let me move out of the university. If you walk into the public schools, there aren't very many good teachers. There really aren't very many good teachers. You can count them on one hand in most schools. And there are an awful lot of people just putting in their time and just goofing off, going through the motions because the kids aren't responsive, they don't give a damn. And I've got friends in Tucson, where we're going, who are teachers, who are just totally discouraged by that culture in the schools. How do we compensate for the fact that there is mediocrity, if not worse, if not incompetence, in the classroom? Even though it's high touch, we've got to get better quality instruction, and we know we can do that with technology. Between computers and TV and programmed instruction and all sorts of things, we can raise the quality of instruction, so that we can guarantee the kids get a better break. And in the process, we circumvent some of the mediocrity and some of the incompetence. But we've got to do it in a way that continues the motivation, because even some of these mediocre people can, maybe they don't teach so well, but they sure have maybe motivational skills, I don't know, or God knows. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. At least they're there, it's surveillance at any rate. That level of motivation that says you will study this hour, or at least you will sit in your seat and open your book, something or other. And
perhaps somewhat like your parents in that the framework that they place you in and help you or encourage perhaps you is as important as what they teach you.
Perhaps to set the environment, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I know, you know, looking back at my own family, and I think yours, is that education was really important in mm-hmm. my family. They weren't nearly as well educated, but mm-hmm. the value was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is what you're saying, is that we need to continue the value in the touch as we increase the competence of the instruction.
To keep people, you know, convinced this is the way to go.
Right. Yeah. What were the, just such a